This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 1st of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we're asking, how close are fact and fiction? Because we've recently been wondering just what happens when those lines blur, as they do all the time, whether you're a leader writer for a daily newspaper or a novelist existing only in the make-believe, or so you think. A couple of weeks ago, The New Yorker wrote about one of its best-loved old writers, Joseph Mitchell, who, it seemed, sometimes amalgamated his interviewees and characters in his non-fiction pieces. So while are they fiction or are they non? And if he can do it, maybe anyone's allowed to. On today's programme, then, we'll be speaking to the most wonderful novelist and a former travel writer, Lawrence Osborne, on how he separates fact from fiction.
If you edit a non-fiction book, you're always being told to make an argument. And of course, this making of the argument is very artificial. And the older you get, the older I got, the more artificial I found it, and the more grating I found it. I didn't really want to write about these things in this way.
We'll also be speaking to the well-loved British stand-up comedian and author Mark Watson about which bits of your real life you can turn into the entertainment that is your stand-up routine. And we'll speak to Monocle's own Budapest correspondent, also a novelist, about what goes in the book and what stays in the newspaper, fact or fiction. That's all to come right here on this edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. First of all, to separate fact from fiction, we're going to speak to the novelist and travel writer Lawrence Osborne, freshly invigorated by publishing his latest novel, Hunters in the Dark. Having written The Majestic Ballad of a Small Player last year, and with non-fiction books such as The Naked Tourist and Bangkok Days under his belt too, Lawrence was keen to talk about the place where fact ends and fiction begins.
I suppose the reason why I stopped doing that sort of non-fiction travel stuff was because I began living in places. I mean, I wrote a book on Bangkok in 2008, and when I look back on it now, I thought I knew what I was writing about, and now I realize that I'm not so sure that I knew what I was writing about.
It's a tough thing. I wonder whether you get the commission to write a book on a certain subject, let alone, we talked about all travel writing or anything, no matter, anything non-fiction is journalism. And you kind of almost have to deal with that. Not you, but one as a writer has to deal with that.
It's a trend now to think of non-fiction books as a kind of art form, as a form of memoir, as a form of this, form of that. But essentially, yeah, in the more ample sense of the term, it is journalism. And I did, you know, I was a journalist for a long time, so I know what journalism is and I know how you do it. There's a certain carpentry involved in it, which is interesting, actually, and I think it's a young man's game. I didn't want to keep doing it. I think it was interesting to do at a certain point. But the idea of traveling to certain places and writing things about them, I was reading some of Graham Greene's journalism from Vietnam in the 50s the other day. You know, he publishes very long pieces, which I suppose later morphed into The Quiet American, but you know, at the time He was writing these long pieces, very beautifully written, would never get past an editor at The New Yorker, because they just rewrite it, you know. But back in the 50s, you could write these very, very long, flowing, poetic pieces. And I was reading it when I was in Saigon last month, but it was a correspondence, as far as I could tell, between that kind of journalism and what I was seeing around me. But I don't know many people are doing that now. Certainly not in the form of magazine or newspaper journalism, you know.
And you mentioned superstition, and that's one of the things that can't help but crop up in your latest novel, Hunters in the Dark, where an Englishman is abroad and has his identity switched almost accidentally in what becomes a sort of enthralling chase after a bag of cash through Cambodia.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you about the idea of superstition. It does, in the end, almost stop some of the characters from doing certain things, doesn't it?
Well, yes, and that book is a certain way also about the idea of karma. Is karma a superstition? Yeah. Is the idea of Dharma and Buddhist, is that a superstition? Well, if you believe it, it's not quite a superstition. It's something else, isn't it? Especially if you organize your conduct around it. Karma was presumably devised in order to guide people's behavior, change people's behavior, improve people's behavior. I mean, my girlfriend is a practicing Buddhist. She's trying to, I mean, I can see that she believes in karma in a way that informs her behavior, not to her regret all the time, or anyone's regret, but we have it. It's like a sort of belief in damnation if you're a Christian or something, or any number of other things. Now, in terms of folk superstition or animist superstition, which is how I think we mean that term now, I think when you live in a Western country, when you live in a Western, you grow up in a Western environment, superstitions are things that you put into a kind of mental island and you separate yourself from them.
Because they're the silly things that don't seem to come from a religious core.
It's like my mother putting out a bowl of milk for the fairies every night, which she did because she was from the west of Ireland and her mother did that. So in my Irish side of my family, the elves and goblins and all that stuff was still there. It was still in the DNA in a way. But of course, I'm more English than Irish in terms of upbringing and education. So no, I don't think that way. I'm post-enlightenment creatures. It's very interesting for me to get to live in Southeast Asia and to sink slowly into it and to realize that, and in fact, the fact that everyone around me believes in these things doesn't upset or annoy me at all. I don't believe in them, but I don't mind being surrounded by people who do. And it does change the way you intuit certain things in a way that I can't really verbalize. It's not a very easy thing to sort of rationalize. But when I look at my balcony in Bangkok, I look down at all these little spirit houses, which are sort of glimmering away in the dark. And these are the little houses where they put the souls of the dead, and they put little flowers and offerings of food. So they put food in these little houses because they're still eating. They're still there. Every time you destroy a house in Bangkok, you have to build a spirit house. You have to, even every time you build a cinema and you knock down a house, you have to put a spirit house. So every single public building, even nightclubs, have spirit houses outside, you know. It's amazing. Every single building has a spirit house.
To house the people that have been unhoused by it.
And you realize that they have a conversation with the dead. Superstition, that we call superstition, is a dialogue with the dead. It's a way of staying in contact with the dead. Nothing is more precious in the human present than talking with the dead in a certain way. That's something we've lost. I mean, frankly.
You know. And we call it superstition with a small s because we are doing a thing of journalism here, because we're talking about your books, which are set in a country in which we're not recording this program.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether fiction was a more natural way of absorbing your sinking into the culture in which you have moved to, rather than journalism, when you are always having to, the gaze is different. Yes. You're not in it, you're looking outside it.
That's
looking
right.
In.
That's exactly right. Very well put. Because journalism ultimately is rational. It's a rational construction. It's a way of creating dialogue. I mean, you cannot write a poetically irrational you can, but in a way you have to make an argument. If you edit a nonfiction book with an editor, you're always being told to make an argument, especially at American houses. You know, you have to make an argument, you have to make a blah, blah, blah. And of course, this making of the argument is very artificial. And the older you get, the older I got, the more artificial I found it, and the more grating I found it. I didn't really want to write about these things in this way.
Because you're forced to pass judgment on something, because really that's what you're being paid for.
Yeah, and in fact, the passing of judgment, the great problem with contemporary Western journalism is its constant need to pass judgment, its constant need to evaluate things it doesn't understand.
The novel that's out this year, Hunters in the Dark, last year's The Ballad of a Small Player, both of those novels and The Forgiven, which was set in North Africa, have, to me, a sort of fugue-like quality, that the characters inhabit moments where, almost like Ballard characters, they find themselves in weird or straitened circumstances, and rather than trying to extricate themselves, they incorporate themselves. They grow into the jungle around them, if you know what I mean.
Which is
a very attractive place to inhabit as a reader. As a writer?
Well, that's nothing conscious on my part, but that's actually how I feel things. That's how I see the world. I really do. That to me is completely natural. I don't think people fit into these journalist narratives. They're completely fake. Actually, the way we live our lives is largely unconscious. Some people don't agree with that, but I think human beings are like migrating birds. I think they just sort of, I mean, I'm very much a Buddhist in that way. I think it's predetermined. I don't think we have very much control. The idea of not having control over your life is a very curious one. It's the ultimate anti-Western or the anti-American idea of human life. Yeah, of course, you know, like you make certain decisions and so on. But there's a kind of letting go of the determination or what happens at the end. That letting go is an interesting moment, because the tension of holding your life by the scruff of its own neck disappears. But I think in that way, it's a much truer idea. It's a much truer intuition about the way all human beings are, including us. We're not as conscious as we think we are. So in the novels, I wanted to sort of it just comes out that way. That's how it seems true to me. I think this is the tragedy of human life. It's the tragedy of human life. And the comedy of it, if you wanted to write comedy, it's also a comedy in a way, because comedy can also come from not being in control of what you're doing. But tragedy in a deeper sense, because then the idea of karma becomes one that you really understand. It's something that just, there's no breaking away from it. your life is going to be the way it is.
There's a moment in maybe these three novels where the protagonists incorporate themselves into the circumstances in which they find themselves and relax to the point where they might not necessarily reach some point of enlightenment, but the reader almost, I felt that these people were far happier than they were at the beginning because they'd gone through something, they'd come through the other end and realised they didn't need all the stuff they were grappling onto.
As one does, if one gets to that point. I guess most people don't get to that. I don't know. I think the pressure in a European country, in a European society, is to do exactly the opposite. It's always an injunction, always to sort of define everything in yourself, your positions, your moral judgments. All this has to be sort of neatly constructed so that it's coherent and therefore has credibility. We think of the human credibility of people based on their consistency and their coherence. I mean, I just don't, it's just a view of human beings that I find repellent. And I find it untrue. You know, I don't think it's the beauty of human beings, their incoherence and their, you know.
There's not a lot of sexiness in coherence.
No, exactly. And sex is, and it's very, it's actually very true because there's no vitality in it and therefore no sexiness. Sex is just the word we give to the fact that there's no erotic charge or there's no...
There's no allure to the...
And there's no charm.
Yeah.
Think about what charm is as a quality. Charm is an old Gaelic word, isn't it? For charisma that comes from a, you know, a heroic leader or something. But it ultimately refers to something quite mystical in people, which is this ability to flow and this ability to kind of, you know, not be in charge of yourself. I think it's also true of writers, by the way. I think the writers who are the most powerful and the most interesting are the writers who are not in charge of their own pathology. They're not the ones who just build laborious research ziggurats and then sort of, that's actually not that interesting. The reader can always see through it. The reader is very intuitive and can always see it. The writers who are most interesting are the ones who surrender to their own intuitions without caring.
You know? Well, that's the thing I wanted to ask you about that, because you used that great phrase, taking your life by the scruff of the neck, is something that you thought was a Western and American obsession with living your life and the, living it in the perceived right way. Do you as a novelist have to take things by the scruff of the neck just to keep them on vaguely on the right railroad track?
Not at all. I mean, even though it may seem in this book, Hunters in the Dark, that it's sort of a neat plot and it has little cogs and levers, funnily enough, it's not pre-planned at all. It's not particularly, I don't have a storyboard. When I hear stories of writers putting their storyboard on a corkboard around their desk with little pins and have it all worked out from beginning to end, it makes me shudder. I just don't know how anybody could do that. I really don't understand it at all. I mean, I start with an idea, a premise, a few things, emotion, whatever. There could be lots of things. But as that story, I have no idea what's going to happen in the book. Because I think there's a certain way you can apply that same idea to the characters that you've created. They roll in a gradient. And halfway through the book, you realize that the gradient is the gradient. It can't be anything else. They're like ball bearings. They go down the slope. There's nothing to be done, and there's nothing, you just follow them. I don't think there's any sense, there's no great, you know, constructional difficulty in doing that. You just follow them. There's a way of doing that. It's not that it's necessarily technically easy. After all, you're telling a story, and stories have to sort of work in a certain
way. But presumably that's instinct, an idea of instinct. It's having absorbed 1,000 stories, 100,000 stories, and knowing the feel of a story, knowing the weight and the progress by which a reader or the writer of the story has to progress through it.
Well, stories are mysterious things, aren't they? You know, Patricia Highsmith said once that the thing of really profound value is the story, which is, I would say, goes against most modern literature, contemporary serious literature, or literature that thinks of itself as serious.
That it could be four lines on the back of a cigarette packet.
Right, but right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. What is profound value is in the story. And as she pointed out many times, the story is the most difficult thing of all because it's the one where your intuition comes into play the most. It's not what people think. People think the plot is artificial and constructed and therefore not as profound as style. I happen to completely disagree. Think the story itself is the style, is the thing that you're telling. It's the thing that you're doing. I have an idea of a story, but it's not formed. But I find that if the book is working, because I write a lot of things that don't work, I write lots of novels that don't work, but in the novels that do work, you find that the story begins to unconsciously click as you go along. It makes sense. It makes moral sense. Moral sense, not aesthetic sense, just a moral sense. It's feeling that the characters must evolve in this way. So I want it to have that feeling of inevitability in the book.
And do you write differently because you live in Bangkok and because you are sinking into this culture, that it is foreign, that you are interested, that you are maybe slightly frustrated, but you are interested every day? You don't know what you'll be doing at the end of that day.
I don't know because I think writers write wherever. I mean, I'm staying in a foundation in Italy right now and I'm, you know, in this beautiful idyllic place, as I just said, in Bruce Chapman's room, you know, and it's ambiguous for me. I'm not sure I'm writing that. I'm not sure it's really working on that front. I'll wait and see. I have another month to go back, you know, but so I don't know. It's perhaps because I know that environment so well and it's nothing in it surprises me, you know. Bangkok is a very good city for a writer, and I don't know why people don't live there, but because you can be very alone there.
I guess people have preconceived ideas of what a writerly city is. People think they should be in Dublin or they should be in New York City.
Kiss of death. Kiss of death.
Yes.
I mean, why would you be in New York? It's absurd.
Yeah.
I mean, I was there 20 years. I mean, trust me, I know. You know, I know New York really, really well. I know how it's changed. You couldn't possibly do it now. And apart from the fact that you're paying $4,000 a month rent to live in a shithole, yeah. Which is really not good. You need calm and space and affordability. These things so that you're not worrying about other things. And you need a freedom from those certain things. It's a very anomalous thing that a writer needs. Very harder and harder to get. I saw a piece last year, Will Self, claiming that the average British writer earns £11,000 a year. Well, what's the average rent for a studio in London? Yeah. The math doesn't add up. Yeah.
I think there we have found the answer to the difference between facts and fiction.
Yeah, exactly.
Lawrence Osborne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to speak to a funny man, Mark Watson. Now, comedians are particularly good at blurring the lines between fact and fiction, often drawing on their own experiences, but perhaps adding in a few white lies to ensure the anecdote gets a few laughs. But how much can stand-up rely on the truth, and how much of what they say is plucked from thin air? When your skill set lies in imagination and the delivery of a punchline, a truthful series of unfortunate events to regale to your audience is surely just an added bonus. Georgina Godwin met Mark Watson at the recent Hay Festival in Wales to discuss this further.
Once I was at Temple Meads, quite late at night, I was about 16 or 17, and I was just sitting there, minding my own business, on a bench, and a bloke sat down next to me and put his hand on my leg. That sort of reaction is pretty much what my brain was doing. Nervous laughter, stroke, terror.
I think all stand-ups embellish their lives to some extent, because what makes it a comedy show rather than just listening to someone talking is the art of embellishment. But I would say that actually embellish is quite a good word. I rarely make anything up outright. I don't sort of tell out and out lies on stage, even though I'd sort of be entitled to do that because it is an act. But I do constantly mine the real business of my life for slightly funnier stuff. So I suppose I couldn't really do it in terms of percentages, but I'd say roughly I'm sort of on stage, I'm speaking kind of two-thirds of the truth to one-third, hopefully amusing artistic exaggeration. I've got no compunction about doing that. I'd play up any story to make it funnier because that is my job, but I'm not that good at completely fabricating things. Some people will just say this happened on the way here, or a funny thing happened last week, this sort of standard patter that comics have, and it's absolute invention. I tend to like there to be some sort of basis in reality. Just I feel more confident if I'm embellishing rather than just inventing.
And how much can you get away with talking about your family and people close to you?
That's a question that I often ask myself, how much I can bring other people in. I think I'm quite kind of wary of doing it. I don't mention my family all that much really on stage. I mean, I do that's sort of appropriately. There's the sound, that's not my family, but there's the sound of loud children in the background reminds you how difficult it is to escape from families. My children are currently too young to understand that they're in my act. My wife obviously isn't, and even with the kids, I only mention them so much really, enough to kind of, it would be odd not to mention them at all, because one of the major sources of comedy for somebody my age is the trials of family life. But I don't draw on it as heavily as some people. Part of it is out of a sort of respect for them, and I think it would be weird for a kid to grow up knowing that they were sort of the butt of their father's routines. I wouldn't have particularly liked to get to 10 and realise that there was a legacy of 4 or 5 years of jokes about me in the public domain. I mean, my dad was a chemistry teacher, so it was not the same situation. But with YouTube and things like that these days, I do think that if you put material out there about real people, there's much more of a chance, A, that it will get back to them, and B, that it will be seen by a large number of people that they wouldn't necessarily want it to be. And also, I think I've got a certain regard for my own privacy. I'd rather not talk that much about my family, partly because, as I say, I don't make things up entirely. Most of what I say does have some sort of kind of foundation in reality, and so there are aspects of family life you don't really want to go into the public domain. So I do draw on my family life, but I'm fairly sparing with biographical detail, autobiographical detail, out of a mixture of respect for them and the desire not to be beaten up by my wife.
How far is the Mark Watson that we see on stage a construct?
It's really hard to say, because most comedians or performers of any kind are putting forward some sort of construct on stage, but it doesn't mean that it's not based in reality. I suppose, in a sense, it's barely a construct at all, because I don't really speak differently on stage or address different subjects. There are very few opinions that I'd offer on stage that I don't actually hold in real life. So in some senses, as a sort of guide to my brain, my comedy is fairly accurate. But on stage, I do come across as a kind of happy-go-lucky extrovert to some extent, and that is definitely a construct. In real life, I'd be much less inclined to sort of bang on as freely as I do. Even that, though, it's not so much a deliberate construct. It's just kind of a Jekyll and Hyde thing. I think, like a lot of comedians, I do tend to come alive from the stimulus of being on stage. So it's not so much that I get on stage and think, right, I'd better start jumping about and yelling and being much more animated. It's more that being on stage just does have that effect on me. So it releases a side of myself which I don't normally access.
And just finally, I mean, for you, and you probably obviously can't speak for all comedians, but it's that line between fact and fiction. There's no way of actually pinning it down, is there?
There really isn't, especially not now when there are so many things like, for example, the podcast Serial that was basically all fact but presented with the kind of excitement of fiction, and so much fiction draws so heavily on real events, and plus pretty much all authors are writing about, they're drawing on things that have really happened. I suppose that's inevitable. So there is not an easy differentiation between fact and fiction. No, all fiction must contain some sort of fact, otherwise it wouldn't come from anywhere at all. And also everything that's presented to us as fact, as we know, it is liable to be interpreted as fiction as well. Like the news, that however real something is and however kind of finite the possibilities of fiction seem to be, no story is ever as simple as it seems. So where fact and fiction divide is very hard to say for anyone, I think.
Always leave them wanting more. That was the piece of advice my uncle gave me. Always leave them wanting more. That's how he lost his job in disaster relief. But I saved that one for last. My name's Mark Watson. Thanks very much.
That was comedian Mark Watson speaking to Georgine Godwin at the Hay Festival. Funny, ha-ha. Yeah, but not if it's too true, right? Thrillers next. But are they real or are they fake?
Each spring, the Hamburg Messe provides a stage for everyone from seatmakers to dessert chefs, all courting airlines on a mission to be the safest and the most appealing carriers at 30,000 feet.
While past expos have focused on in-flight entertainment as ways to enhance a passenger's experience, this year the idea of augmented reality was front and center. Throughout the halls, makers displayed concepts on what it might mean to leave your seat, all while staying seated.
Flights of Fancy, a filmic look at innovation in the air, premiering now on Monocle.com.
Finally, on this edition of Culture that's been asking how close are fact and fiction, we speak to Monocle's Budapest correspondent Adam Labor, who again is both a newspaper journalist of conscience and renown, but also the writer of thrillers The Geneva Option and The Washington Stratagem, that look at the fictionalized murkiness of the United Nations through his hot heroine Yael Azouli. So how on earth do you decide what stays in the newspaper and what ends up a twist in a thriller?
The thing about fiction is that you take it to another level. So you can have a real life story and then you have to add a dramatic kind of narrative on top of it. Now I'm working on a trilogy of thrillers set in the United Nations. And the first one, The Geneva Option, is about coltan. And coltan's very interesting. It's the world's most important mineral. It's mined in Congo often by children in terrible conditions. And without coltan, we couldn't have our mobile phones, we couldn't have our computers, the modern world wouldn't work really. So that's very interesting in a non-fiction way, because most people still have never even heard of coltan and have no idea that they're kind of, every time they use their phone, they're complicit in this exploitation. But that's not a novel. So the novel is, what if there was a conspiracy to take hold of all the world's supplies of coltan? And how would that conspiracy work? And how would it work through the United Nations? And how would it be stopped? And then you have your heroic protagonist and your evil antagonist, and the obstacles and the clashes and the whole kind of narrative drive that you see in any story. So it's kind of merging them together.
So it's making a fiction out of the fact. I wonder also whether in fiction, and specifically in your fiction, your thrillers which deal with the real world, they fictionalize elements of the real world, the United Nations, as you've said, whether you can tell a larger truth about what actually goes on in organizations like the United Nations through the prism of fiction. You can hint at things that you couldn't in a non-fiction piece.
What you can do with fiction, I mean, you have to be careful, because when you set out to write a novel, you're setting out to tell a story, which is, first of all, you want to provoke, but you want to entertain, you want people to keep turning the pages. So you don't want to really use fiction too much as a kind of coded message system, because then, if you get too didactic, you can turn off the reader. But I think certainly I've written a non-fiction book about the inner workings of the UN, and that kind of inspired my thriller series, because I realised when I was writing the non-fiction book that really there's this incredible dramatic potential here. I mean, if you look at the UN headquarters in New York, it's 38-floor skyscraper, and it's full of, you know, hundreds, if probably well, for thousands of people are working there. And the amount of plotting and intriguing and double-dealing, and throw in the superpower mix there as well, and they're all spying on each other, and, you know, there's been all these stories about how offices have been bugged and everyone's watching and trying to find out what everyone's doing. And I thought, wow, this is a great setting for fiction. And I think that is going to make people think perhaps more about, you know, my version of the UN is a fictionalized version of the UN, but it can make people think more about how superpower politics works, what are the compromises and the deals that are done behind the scenes, rather than if I wrote another non-fiction book sort of saying more about how the UN actually works.
And in terms of writing a protagonist, in your case, the heroine, Yael Azoulay, how do you kind of hit upon a character like that and their key characteristics? Is this an amalgamation of lots of people that you've come into contact with, or is this your kind of fantasy UN employee?
She is beautiful and dangerous and sexy, of course, so there's an element of that. Whenever a male writer writes a female protagonist like that, her job doesn't exist, or if it does, I don't know about it, but I think I would have done by now. Now, she's the covert negotiator for the United Nations Secretary General to do these kind of murky deals behind the scenes until she's asked to do something that she refuses to do. So again, in fiction, you know, you have to explore these themes through the central dilemmas of the protagonist, through a character, because that's what keeps us turning the pages, and that's the same in TV and film. You know, we want to know what's going to happen to the protagonist. You know, they have to be sympathetic, they have to be complex. So it's very much based on character, and she's an invented character. And your character must have a shadowy, dark backstory as well, so he or she can face her inner demons.
And in terms of the research, it'd be nice to know before we go, Adam, whether you research a novel in the same way that you would research a non-fiction piece for a big daily newspaper. Is it the same process, or are you looking for the murk even more in the non-fiction, perhaps, than in the fiction?
You need to understand the basic structure of how it works, how an organisation works. But then you need to see where are the areas where you could have dramatic tension. Where's the conflict? Where's the contradictions? Where's the paradoxes? Where are people being forced to make compromises? Because you just have to dramatize all the time. You know, obviously in a narrative there's downtime as well. It can't be, you know, frenetic pace all the time. But you have to be looking really for a structure that shows the complexity of human behavior, especially under greater and greater pressure.
So that's how he does it. That was Adam Labor in Budapest, whose thriller The Washington Stratagem is out now. Pick the truth from the lies out of that. And there we have it. How close are facts and fiction? There's a cigarette paper between the two, often. We've seen that the creative impulse is kicked off by fact, but that fiction is so much more satisfying to fashion. It is making it up, after all. When journalistic veracity and the search for the truth is at stake, it's best not to get too muddled, but fiction can tell a larger truth, and with some style, where fact can get stuck in the mud. Fiction is the lie through which we tell the truth, said Albert Camus of his art. So how close are facts and fiction? As close as the writer wishes, as near as the comedian can get without needing to get a divorce. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was the real life Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time next week, but for the time being, I've been Robert Bound. Thanks for tuning in.